What if the miracles of Jesus were about something else, something more? What if the power in miracle is meant to be more than just a reset button, a do-over, to take us to a place before we were sick or traumatized, as if it had never happened?
That's the Reverend Dr. Ellen Richardson, and today she brings you a message entitled, The Man with the Withered Hand. I'm Katie Givens-Keim, and this is Day One. Welcome to Day One, where for over 75 years, you've heard outstanding preachers from America's historic Protestant churches, sharing insight and inspiration from God's Word for your life. Today on Day One, we are honored to have with us the Reverend Dr. Ellen Richardson, the former priest in charge of the Episcopal Church of the Advent in Williamston, North Carolina, and the author of Holy Stories and Struggles. Before coming to Advent in 2017, she was assistant rector of St. Anne's Episcopal Church in Tifton, Georgia. Ellen earned a degree in political science from Georgia State University and her MD degree from the Medical College of Georgia and her Master of Divinity from Episcopal Divinity School. After practicing family medicine and hospice and palliative care for 27 years, she began serving full-time as a priest. Now let's tune in for this encore presentation with our host emeritus, Peter Wallace.
Ellen, welcome to Day One.
Thank you.
What a rich life of service you are having. First, you practiced family medicine in rural Tennessee and Georgia for 17 years, followed by 10 years practicing exclusively as a hospice and palliative care physician in Savannah, Georgia, and Northern Virginia. How did your calling to the medical profession come about for you?
That's an interesting question because that takes me way back. I wasn't a traditional science major, pre-med major who went into medicine. I actually thought I was going to law school, changed my mind. And then I went to work for my father in his business, sold sporting goods, of all things, and was looking for something that would create more meaning in my life. Mm-hmm. And I went back to Georgia State, began to take science classes to see if I could pass them. I had never taken any science. And as I passed them one by one, it looked like the dream might happen. And I probably was accepted to medical school at the age of 29 in a wave of intentionality of them accepting a wider variety of type of student at the time.
And I would imagine that your experience over those years plays a major role in the new book you've written, Holy Dying, from Church Publishing. This is a subject many of us tend to shun, but death and illness are such integral parts of our life. It's something especially people of faith should reckon with. How can your book help us to do that?
I think in my medical training and my medical practice, I was drawn to people who were struggling with how to face the end of life. And I feel like in the world of medicine and even in the world of the church, that they weren't necessarily given good tools. And it doesn't mean that people don't receive assistance or help or compassion, but there are a lot of people who find themselves blundering through some of the most precious time that is left to them. And so what I hope that the book would do by using stories to give people access to the information, that I could break down some of the major medical issues and decisions that people are faced with at end of life in plain terms that helps them actually think about whether or not one or another thing might be appropriate for them in their circumstances. I think people make a lot of decisions toward end of life out of fear and anxiety and emotion because we're not very well trained in these conversations because we fear to have them. Families, people that love each other make a lot of assumptions about what other people want. And so I think what I wanted the book to do was encourage conversation.
So when you were a physician working in hospice care and palliative care, how did you approach working with a chaplain?
Most of the time that you spend in hospice and palliative care is in conferences with patients and families. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you would have a family conference that would last an hour or two. Chaplains are always invited and encouraged, including people's personal pastors. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I felt that people's religious support didn't really hold them up mm-hmm. into the places that they were being pulled by the medical community. And that when there's so much talk about miracle and when all of the conversation is upbeat, as if God is going to take care of this mm-hmm. and you're going to be okay and everyone's going to be okay, that people are ill-prepared mm-hmm. when things are not okay. And that I've experienced many times when people felt like failures mm-hmm. in their own faith, because when they weren't cured or healed or when treatment didn't work or when the cancer didn't resolve or when someone didn't wake up after a tremendous neurological insult, that they didn't pray hard enough or that they didn't believe strong enough. And not only were they dealing with the grief of loss, but then they took the blame onto themselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really bad theology. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's how God works, that we have a certain level of faith or prayer that if we can only achieve mm-hmm. that, then everything will be okay. Some of that comes in thinking about quantity and how people approach prayer, and sometimes as if the more people you have praying for you, the more likely you are, mm-hmm. you know, to be healed. And those kind of quantifiable measurements, I think, are very confusing for people mm-hmm. when they're trying to deal with really facing the end of life. And as Christians, we talk a really good game about what we think is going to happen after we die. And sometimes we do really good at that at funerals. We talk about resurrection and being with God, and we talk to children about being in heaven and what that looks like and that we'll meet people again. But when push comes to shove and when we're getting closer and closer to that place, we put the brakes on as much as possible, as if deep down we're really terrified. And what I think helps is when people can have conversations about that terror and mm-hmm. what does that really mean. Mm-hmm.
So you were ordained as an Episcopal priest about 10 years ago and worked bivocationally for about 6 years until retiring from your medical career to work full-time as assistant rector at St. Anne's in Tifton, Georgia. Was that a sudden decision to seek ordination or something that had been building for you over the years?
When I was considering leaving family practice to go into end-of-life care, it involved a move on my part mm-hmm. because I lived in a very small place. So there wasn't enough volume to really learn well. And palliative care was a brand new specialty. Mm-hmm. It was very exciting to me because I was meeting people that were studying and learning, even making science out mm-hmm. of the things that helped people at this time of life. I was very much drawn to that. And at the same time, was going through a personal discernment about ordination. And I really wrestled with the decision of which to do. Some of it had to do with, you know, not being in a position to leave my life and my kids that needed their college education to go to seminary for 3 years. Some of it just had to do with not wanting either thing to go. And I had a spiritual director who looked at me one day and he said, "Why can't you do both?" And that had never occurred to me. I didn't even know that would be an option. Mm-hmm. But as I went through discernment with my diocese, that did become the call. And it was a combination call, if there is such a thing.
Mm-hmm. And as of last December, you've been serving as priest in charge at Church of the Advent in Williamston, North Carolina. How would you describe the people and the ministries of the church there?
Quite lovely. It's an historic church. The congregation's been there since 1850. Mm. There are members who remember being children there, and they're now, you know, in their 60s, 70s. The age of the membership goes from 1 to 94. It's a lovely old Gothic building with a lot of historical significance. But the most wonderful thing about this congregation is their love for each other and their concern for their community. I feel privileged to be able to serve them. I love the heart of parish ministry and the fact that they make room for me to do this other thing. Mm-hmm. And I guess I think that these conversations that I hope will take place in the church it's great to go to a conference or, you know, a workshop or something like that. But I think they fundamentally need to take place within the church family, mm-hmm. with people who love each other and trust each other. And I think that makes them more comfortable conversations.
Well, Ellen, your sermon today draws from the gospel lesson from Mark chapter 3. Would you read it for us?
Again, he entered the synagogue, and a man was there who had a withered hand. They watched him to see whether he would cure him on the Sabbath, so that they might accuse him. And he said to the man who had the withered hand, "Come forward." Then he said to them, "Is it lawful to do good or to do harm on the Sabbath, to save life or to kill?" But they were silent. He looked around them with anger. He was grieved at their hardness of heart and said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was restored. The Pharisees went out and immediately conspired with the Herodians against him, how to destroy him.
Ellen, we look forward to hearing your sermon, "The Man with the Withered Hand." Thank you for sharing it with us.
You're quite welcome. My pleasure.
And if you'd like to listen again to today's program or read or share a transcript of Ellen Richardson's sermon, visit our website at dayone.org. Or for a free printed sermon transcript, call us toll-free at 1-888-411-DAY1.
What is it like to experience a story of healing? When does healing happen, and how do we recognize it? Does healing require a recognizable change in the body to count, or is it really about something else? The healing of the man with the withered hand in today's gospel from Mark is one that happens so quickly that it is almost lost in the greater drama that surrounds it. The scene is a synagogue, a place of teaching and worship. The attention-grabbing characters, the law-loving Pharisees and the power-craving Herodians, have been trailing Jesus and his disciples, a chorus of judges waiting for Jesus to make a mistake that they would be most happy to hold against him. These strange bedfellows, usually political opponents, found it expedient to work together when it came to undermining the authority and credibility of the one they both perceived as a threat, the one called the Messiah. The prelude to the healing involves these enemies of Jesus trailing after his followers through the fields and the town to get to the synagogue. The Pharisees had caught the disciples plucking the heads off the grain as they walked through the fields, probably more an absent-minded reflex, like chewing on a blade of grass, than a deliberate attempt to glean the fields for a meal. This did not keep the Pharisees from accusing them of harvesting on the Sabbath, a gotcha they wasted no time laying on Jesus. Neither the Pharisees nor the Herodians cared much about people, about the human condition. The Pharisees reveled in righteous indignation at this itinerant preacher with his crazy ideas about loving enemies and blessing the ragtag army of the unclean who followed him around. The power-hungry Herodians merely capitalized on an opportunity to use one enemy to combat another. From Jesus, with his inner radar set to detect manipulation and to care about every sheep in the pasture, every lamb in the fold, came exasperation in facing community leaders behaving badly, their hardness of heart breaking his own. Within the crowd of extras listening to the drama, there would have been many kinds of people, each with his or her own special need for healing. One was a man with a withered hand. This unnamed man would have kept a low profile, keeping his deformed hand safely hidden inside his long-sleeved garment. Withered implies some long-standing insult, possibly a congenital malformation, perhaps an accident of birthing, or a terrible trauma which he somehow survived without succumbing to secondary infection. A source of chronic pain, both physical and emotional, his withered hand would have set him apart, confining him to the shadows, not just in that room, but throughout his whole life, long ago having learned that he belonged in isolation as punishment for some unnamed sin for which there was no recourse. With a status as low and unclean as a tax collector or prostitute, his stepping into the limelight as the center of attention, much less into the synagogue at all, would have meant crossing a boundary of decency that should have been off limits to him and his kind. It is not difficult to recognize and feel compassion for the pain and suffering of biblical characters living with the shame and blame of their own afflictions in ancient times. Imagining ourselves in the world Jesus lived in, we easily align ourselves with his anger at those who would make outcasts of others whose illness made them unclean. Yet are attitudes about illness and death very different in our day and time? We would like to think that in the centuries after the Enlightenment, we would have evolved. Knowledge about diseases of the body and the mind, down to the biologic and physiologic drivers from the cell to its genetic code, begets power, and with enough human drive and determination, any insult can be fixed, any disability accommodated, any threat to life and limb overcome, or so we want to believe. Yet are we really free of the fear of becoming helplessly ill? Are we really above assigning subliminal blame to the ill and dying in an all-too-human attempt to distance ourselves from the same thing happening to us? Believing in our power to conquer sickness and death, leaving no stone unturned, we seek well-trained professional help when we get sick and know that medicines and sometimes surgery will be offered to keep us going. When our organs fail, we accommodate their work for us by using machines to accomplish their tasks. And when we are unable to keep living, even with other people's organs, when death seems inevitable, we can choose to have our bodies frozen, hoping that in some future time we can be thawed out and cured of an insult that was incurable in our own lifetime. Our metaphor to defeat insult and conquer death is one of war, where every day of life at any cost is considered a battle victory. No challenge too great, no obstacle too overwhelming. It is not even much of a stretch to think that a man with a withered hand could be swept from our world into a galaxy far, far away, to be given a replacement mechanical hand as good as new, just like Luke Skywalker. Waiting for healing to come in some afterlife has no appeal at all. From our context of living in a hubris-laden world of medical miracles, we understandably wrestle with the healing miracles of Jesus, because what we like to refer to as the best medical care system in the world cannot really fix everything, despite our desires and expectations. And because we continue to fear we will die before we are ready, we hedge our bets and pray for miracles. In my medical career, I've occasionally known patients with unexplained resolution of disease and hold those stories in a sacred place of mystery where the unexplained remains unexplained. What is certain is that not everyone gets a miracle. More often than not, a withered hand stays withered, forsaken. What if the miracles of Jesus were about something else, something more, beyond a backup plan, beyond a drop of magic landing on those who earned it by some inherent goodness or deep belief or fervent prayer? What if the power in miracle is meant to be more than just a reset button, a do-over, to take us to a place before we were sick or traumatized, as if it had never happened? Though sometimes done before witnesses for a specific purpose, such as to show it was more important to heal than to pick apart behaviors on the Sabbath, Jesus often healed in private and frequently asked witnesses not to tell anyone about what he had done. Not just opportunities to show off, healing miracles demonstrated the power of God. More importantly, they demonstrated his compassion and his willingness to cross the boundaries between clean and unclean, worthy and unworthy. He spoke to touched, loved, and wept with those who were healed, not just from disease, but also from isolation and shame inflicted upon them by those who put rules over people. Jesus broke the rules to heal people, to restore them to a fullness of life denied by their afflictions. He did not use healing as a weapon against his enemies, nor did he dispense healing like magic from a distance that would keep him untainted. Jesus entered into the suffering of others, a response not of pity, but of empathy. And this is how healing happened, even to the man with the withered hand. Out of sadness and anger at the world's hardness of heart came abundant love to heal the withered hand and to transform the man's life with abundant courage and resilience and promise and hope, bringing him out of the shadows and into the light. It is in this healing movement of Jesus, not just from Galilee to Jerusalem, but in his turning from appeasement of the powerful towards solidarity with the suffering, that we are saved, that we are all healed. By this great and holy mystery, even the fear of illness and death, which sends us fleeing from the suffering of others, can be transformed by the cross, less a symbol of death and destruction, and more one of sacrificial healing and restoration. By the power of Jesus to turn rejection, betrayal, and hardness of heart into compassion, we are healed. By his wounds, we are healed. All that is needed is for us to step out of the shadows and stretch out our hand. Amen. Let us pray. Holy God, in the light of your resurrection, pour out your healing over our pain, our grief, our isolation, and our failure to trust your presence in sickness and in health, in living and in dying. Give us the courage to follow Jesus across boundaries into solidarity with the suffering, and to hold out our hands always for your deeply mysterious and holy gift of restoration. Amen.
Our preacher today was the Reverend Dr. Ellen Richardson, former priest in charge at the Episcopal Church of the Advent in Williamston, North Carolina. For a free transcript of her sermon entitled The Man with the Withered Hand, you can visit us online at dayone.org. And remember, for over 75 years now, we've depended on the support and contributions of faithful listeners like you. We hope you might consider contributing to this ministry financially or by sharing Day One with your family and friends, or simply by including our Day One radio and podcast ministries in your prayers. Send your tax-deductible donation to Day One, 3535 Peachtree Road Northeast, Suite 520/714, Atlanta, Georgia, 30326. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim. Next week, we are so pleased to have with us the Reverend Dr. Joy J. Moore, Vice President for Academic Affairs, Academic Dean, and Professor of Biblical Preaching at Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. Her sermon on a challenging passage from 1 Samuel 8 is entitled Trading Our Sorrows. That's next week, right here on Day One. Ellen Richardson offers some final reflections on today's message with our host emeritus, Peter Wallace.
Ellen, thank you for a beautiful message. You helped us see this man with a withered hand in a new light. For one thing, his ailment likely set him in isolation with a status as low and unclean as a tax collector or prostitute, so he really crossed a boundary of decency, and in the synagogue at that, in reaching out to Jesus, you told us. Are there current-day parallels that might help us better grasp what's happening here?
I think in our society, we're aware that we have huge problems with paying for medical care, with providing medical care, with access to medical care. And it varies from place to place, but it definitely varies with people having personal resources and health insurance. And it makes me think about the unnamed, the people whose only access to medical care is emergency rooms or walk-in clinics. Sometimes they get swept up into the system and get good care. Sometimes they get more care than they really need. But what's been lost, I think, in my perspective, since I practiced family medicine in a small town, was relationships with patients. I think physicians mourn this loss, and many of them leave the profession in droves. It's a challenge for new physicians to learn in the same mode and under the time pressures and constraints that they're given based on economics. A lot has been lost in terms of actually having the kind of relationship that is modeled by Jesus in the way that he reached out and saw people. In the system we're in now, even as a patient, I have the experience of being unseen. You know, I'm a name on a piece of paper, an insurance claim, you know, a problem that has a solution or needs a prescription. But it's rare when I find a place where there's actually a relationship between the one seen as a healer and the one who needs to be healed.
You spoke about the common desire to do whatever medically possible to overcome illness and conquer death. And in your medical career, you have known patients with an inexplicable resolution of disease. But not everyone gets a miracle, you said, and more often than not, a withered hand stays that way. When and how should we accept that reality in our fight for health, for ourselves or for our loved ones?
That's the big question, and that's why we should be having conversations about this before we're in the emotional crux of a crisis. We usually make decisions about ourselves or our loved ones in crisis without any preparation or understanding. And nothing I say applies to everyone, of course. But in my experience, the people who have had a dying experience that was full of grace and blessing and legacy are people who prepared themselves for it spiritually, financially, if possible, emotionally with their families. They spoke about it openly. They spoke about the things that they wanted to accomplish, and they worked on that. And they spoke about their own fears of it, and yet their hope about what was to come after. All I can do is hold that up. And in some ways, the way I have seen people die has been the miracle. The miracle, in some cases, has been reconciliation of long broken relationships before a death that only happened because someone was about to die. Sometimes the miracle was just watching tremendous tenderness and caregiving or tremendous compassion for one person, for another, even maybe someone who wasn't a relative or a loved one. Those are the kind of miracles that I think are what I'm talking about in a broader context of healing, and not just simply sort of a magic erasure of the bad thing that's happening.
Ellen Richardson, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for asking.
We hope you'll join us next week as Day One carries on the rich legacy of over 75 years of inspirational preaching, broadcasting and podcasting the voice of America's mainline Protestant churches. I'm Reverend Dr. Katie Givens-Keim, wishing you all God's blessings on Day One and forever.